Ms. Thompson worked at the Commission for Persons with Disabilities in Cambridge, Massachusetts for 10 years, retiring at the end of 2009. This past fall, Carolyn gave the keynote address for the UCC National Widening the Welcome Inclusion for All Conference, where I had the opportunity to meet her and hear her speak and was inspired by her words. She has a chapter on titled Ableism, The Face of Oppression in the Lives of People with Disabilities in the book Injustice and the Care of Souls, Taking Oppression Seriously in Pastoral Care. Her volunteer work in the disability field began in the early 1980s in Austin, Texas. Carolyn has two grown daughters and is a person with a lifelong disability. So without further ado, and not to take up any more time from Carolyn's lecture, I introduce to you Carolyn Thompson.
I'm really glad to be here, and I applaud Lancaster Theological Seminary on having a Disability Awareness Week. For groups in the United States and in the World Council of Churches, Ecumenical Disability Advocates, one of the most important things we think that needs to be done is introducing disability studies into theological seminaries to better prepare our clergy and lay people. And this is a great beginning. Worship service yesterday was amazing. A beautiful expression of faith shared by members of the Friendship community. The testimony of struggle, healing, and grace given by Betsy Ivy. Hopefully my words today can fill in some background and challenge us to move forward as we consider this complex subject of disability. I want to begin with a verse from one of the songs that we sang yesterday. Please join in.
I'll be helping with leading the song. It's to the tune of This Is the Day, and the first verse we will sing is We Are the People That the Lord Has Made, and then the next verse we'll sing is I am a person that the Lord has made. So let's sing together. We are the people, we are the people that the Lord has made.
We will rejoice
and be glad in it. We are the people that the Lord has made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. We are the people,
we are the people
that the Lord has made. I am a person,
I am a person
that the Lord has made,
that the Lord has made.
I will rejoice,
I will
and be glad in it.
And be glad in it.
I am a person that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. I am a person.
I am a person
that the Lord has made.
Wonderful. Thank you. I am a person with a disability that the Lord has made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. In reading from the first chapter of Genesis, we hear a reading from the first chapter of Genesis tells us that in the beginning, God created the heavens and earth from a formless void, separated the day from the night, put lights in the sky, gathered the water together, let the dry land appear, brought forth vegetation, sea creatures, birds of the air, and animals on the land. And finally, humankind created in God's likeness. What a diversity of surroundings and life. It's very clear from this account that abundance, complexity, variety, and difference are an essential part of God's master plan. We are also told that at every step of the way, God looked over the new creation and declared it very good. Some say it takes all of us together to reflect God's likeness, as if we're each a piece of the puzzle, or in this part of the country, a piece of the quilt pattern, and that it takes all of us to make up this Imago Dei. If humankind is made in this image of God, how do we describe it? How do we envision this God whose likeness we are to reflect? The creation story certainly portrays God as an imaginative source of abundance and diversity. God is, other pictures are given to us in other stories of scripture that show us a God who is intelligent, patient, provides for all our needs. Other words that have historically have been used are majestic, omnipotent, transcendent, all-knowing, unchanging, eternal. But we also know God to be steadfast, loving, and selfless. Thinking about how we can emulate such characteristics can be daunting. Humans are endowed with strength and endurance. Some have suggested that it is our intellect and ability to reason that most closely reflect God's likeness. Theologians like Karl Barth emphasize relationality of this Trinitarian God, and that we portray this image when we respond to the Creator and to one another in loving relationships. I'm sure we can each think of people we know who exhibit some of these qualities that we have attributed to God. But I wonder how often you think of a disabled individual as being made in the image of God. If this is a challenging concept, why might it be so? Is it because so much of our religious background and Christian teaching speaks of God as a powerful change agent, and we think of people with disabilities as powerless and in need of care? How accurate is our knowledge of disability? How do we define it? What sources have informed our perceptions? Where do we get our information? I'll begin with the Bible and instructions like those in Leviticus that say, the person who has the leprous disease shall live alone outside the camp. No one who has a blemish may draw near. One who is blind or lame, has a mutilated face, or a limb too long, a hunchback, is a dwarf, or has a blemish in his eye or an itching disease, shall come near the altar. If you spurn my statutes and break my covenant, I will bring terror on you, consumption and fever that waste the eyes and cause the life to pine away. I know these passages related to a specific time and context, but their vivid imagery has colored perceptions of disability through the ages. Another source of information is the medical model of disability, and that relies on a diagnosis to define the whole problem and solution. The emphasis is on correcting a deficit in the individual. And the person with a disability is always seen as the sick patient in need of corrective treatment or surgery. I think we've let this biblical focus on healing become a fixation on cure. It is this medical model that has influenced our language and the habit of referring to people with disabilities as patients, even when they are not in a medical setting. Literature, film, media, and the internet are full of stories and accounts involving people with disabilities. though usually as a prop in someone else's story, or playing the narrowly prescribed roles of inspirational hero, tragic victim, naive dupe, comic sidekick, or evil villain. Such stereotypes perpetuate images of disability as scary, pathetic, burdensome, shameful, somehow outside the realm of normal life experience. Unfortunately, I think that one of the ways many people get their information about disability is through all the requests they get from charitable contributions. While some of this money might be put to good use, these campaigns are generally disempowering to people with disabilities. They portray us as pathetic victims, helpless beggars who can do nothing but sit on the side of the road asking for handouts. And finally, our negative concepts of disability are shaped by the various insurance definitions of disability and the Social Security determinations for Supplemental Security Income and Social Security Disability Insurance, where in order to receive any assistance, the person with a disability has to be declared totally incapacitated, incapable of ever again being able to gainfully support themselves. These sources all paint a pretty dismal picture, so that many view life with disability as a tragedy. I like what Neil Marcus says, "Disability is not a brave struggle or courage in the face of adversity. Disability is an art. It's an ingenious way to live." In the past 40 years, as people with disabilities have founded their own advocacy organizations, there's been a growing tendency to see disability as an evolving concept, a complex, multidimensional experience. Let's consider a few models and definitions that take a broader look at this issue and may provide some helpful avenues to solving problems associated with disability. The social model of disability identifies systemic barriers, negative attitudes, and exclusionary practices that identify society as the main contributory factor in disabling people. This social model says that a person may have a physical, sensory, intellectual, or psychological impairment or functional limitation, but these do not in and of themselves lead to disability unless society fails to take account of and include people with disabilities regardless of their differences. The World Health Organization uses a definition that's a little different. It sees functioning and disability as a dynamic interaction between health conditions and contextual factors, both personal and environmental. And in similar language, the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities stresses that disability results from the interaction between persons with impairments and the attitudinal and environmental barriers that hinder their full and effective participation in society on an equal basis with others. One of the slogans that has become popular among people with disabilities says, "Nothing about us without us." This came out of South Africa, I think. In other words, don't try to label us, describe our lives, fix our problems, or determine our futures without our input. Just like Indigenous peoples around the world, we in the disability community have the right to name ourselves. Individuals who used to be referred to as dwarfs or midgets have chosen to call themselves little people. People who use sign language refer to themselves as deaf. Many individuals with intellectual disabilities refer to themselves as self-advocates. A colleague of mine, whose body bears many of the characteristics of individuals whose mothers took thalidomide, describes himself as having unique architecture. Recent census figures tell us that people with disabilities make up nearly 20% of the population in the United States. One in every 3 to 4 families includes an individual with a disability. And the incidence of disability increases with age. Disability also has a bidirectional link with poverty, which makes it a huge development issue. Poverty often contributes to disability, disabling conditions, and people with disabilities often live in poverty. A report released in 2011 by the World Health Organization and World Bank put the global figure at 1 billion people with disabilities. That's out of a worldwide population of 7 billion. This is not a small group. I think we often think there are a lot fewer people with disabilities because not all of them are visible. As advancements in medicine, science, and technology continue to reduce the death rate from infection, injuries, and chronic illness, people are more likely to survive events that would have killed them 10 to 30 years ago. But they frequently continue life with some impairment. The disability community is a minority group that anyone can join. While people with all kinds of impairments may know exclusion, discrimination, and oppression, this is not a homogeneous group. The experience of disability varies greatly from one person to the next, due to differences in age, gender, socioeconomic status, healthcare, sexuality, ethnicity, education, cultural heritage, and religion. Some people are born with disabling health conditions and others become disabled later in life. Impairments may be readily apparent or not so obvious, what we sometimes refer to as hidden disabilities. Disability does not fit into neat, orderly categories. It is not one of those adventures we can arrange on our own terms. Life with disability tends to be full of paradox, unpredictability, and sometimes pain. Encountering disability can feel like having one's life turned upside down, whether it's one's own or that of a friend or family member. Learning to negotiate the land of disability where nothing is familiar can feel like culture shock. Most people who have been disabled for some time acknowledge that they had to learn how to integrate disability into their lives, to live with it, not overcome it. That does not mean it is easy. One needs to learn the difference between acceptance and giving up. Disability directly challenges many fundamental assumptions we've acquired over time. But rather than confront this discomfort, we often shroud the subject in silence and try to distance ourselves from it. Too often, by not acknowledging our own vulnerability, we project our fears and anger onto those with disabilities. These people then become the scapegoats who bear our own inadequacies and pain. We either condemn them or venerate what we interpret as their suffering. Although we may not anticipate it, disability is a natural occurrence in our lives, a contingency of being human. Helen Keller said, "Life is a great adventure or nothing at all." And we know that most great adventures entail an element of danger and a probability that we may incur some injury along the way. Living is risky business. It's been the Creator's design to place this breath of life in fragile earthen vessels. So, can people with disabilities reflect the image of God? Earlier, when I was naming some of the familiar descriptors that we use for God, did I include everything? All God's attributes? What about vulnerability, helplessness, dependency, and servanthood? Just consider the creation story. How could God be more vulnerable than to create humankind and then endow us with the freedom to reject the Creator's love? What about these aspects of Jesus' life and death? How do they bear witness to the image of God? Jesus arrived on earth as a helpless infant entrusted to the care of a simple peasant couple. He came from a small rural village, from the geographic edge of civilization. He depended on the hospitality of others for shelter and food. He associated with sick and unclean people. Jesus put himself in harm's way and broke the rules of his society, knowing that it would make the religious and civil authorities nervous and angry. He stayed true to his identity even when he knew it put his life in danger. He took on the role of servant, washing the disciples' feet. He was condemned to death by crucifixion like a common criminal. And the body of the risen Christ still bears the impairments from the torture of that crucifixion. And yet he changed the world. In Thomas Reynolds' book, Vulnerable Communion, A Theology of Disability and Hospitality, vulnerability plays an essential role in his theology of disability. He stretches us to think of the imago Dei in terms of creativity, availability, and relationality. He says that insofar as we are creative, recognize and honor our relationship to humans and other creatures and the earth, and make ourselves available to one another with respect, compassion, and fidelity, we mirror God's image. Perhaps most importantly, Reynolds talks about interdependence. We each long for a sense of home, a place of belonging. This means welcoming the presence of the other. We find our identity, we come to know ourselves and the fullness of life through our relationships with others. Paul has similar words for the church in Corinth about the importance of each member. In 1 Corinthians, he compares the church to the human body and points out how each part is essential. The body could not function at all if it were just hands or legs or eyes, if each part were identical to the next. He also says, "Now there are varieties of gifts, but the same Spirit, and there are varieties of service, but the same Lord, and there are varieties of activities, but it is the same God who activates all of them in everyone. To each is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. If one member suffers, all suffer with it. If one member is honored, all rejoice with it." Paul was very clear in his comparison of the church to the human body that one member could not say, "Since I cannot perform like you, I do not belong. Or since you are not like us, we do not need you." No one is to be more important than the others, and no one is to see himself or herself as so insignificant as to be unnecessary to the whole. Even the parts that seem the weakest are essential. There's a place for everyone to belong. The focus on individualism in this country has put so much emphasis on being self-sufficient that we've forgotten we were created to be in relationship with one another. We are interdependent. Let us imagine that even people with disabilities are part of the variety that God intends for creation. Each person has something vital to contribute, a gift for the building up of the whole body. It can be the gift of leadership, or simply a hug, or a smile. We need each other for our gifts to be revealed. Individuals with disabilities, as well as our families and friends, have many gifts to share precisely from our experience of disability. Tom Reynolds also writes about how a culture constructs or adopts a framework to identify itself, and how the myth, or what he calls the cult of normalcy, holds sway here in the United States. Such a framework as the cult of normalcy is built on insecurity, a sense of scarcity, and a fear of difference. Scholars in other disciplines like political science, anthropology, sociology have come up with similar theories to explain the power dynamics in a given society and what happens to the people who are marginalized by the dominant group. In her essay, Set Apart, Called Into the Midst, M.R. Ritley also writes about the myths a culture creates and what happens when they are discovered to be untrue. She says, "We humans, as creatures, are frail, utterly incomplete. Of all the creatures in the known world, we alone are born without a single natural way of life. We are incomplete in instinct and capacity. We build cultures because we cannot live without them. It is our nature to create, as well as our need to create, a pattern within which we can live at all. God not only gifted us with the capacity to grow, to discover, to create, this same God provided us with an endless need to do so. It is out of our frailty that we evoke our greatest gifts. All visions of reality are by their nature mythic, mythic constructions which we superimpose on what would otherwise be a chaos of event and gesture. Myth is the lens we look through, the means we use to define the shape of the world we see. We might say then that a myth derives its power when it is a reasonably accurate description of the way life is experienced. For the well-entrenched sixth-generation Anglo who occupies a position of power and whose life is cushioned with enough economic and social resources to make it an affirmative, orderly existence, the American myth is no myth at all. It is the way things obviously are and are meant to be. The question is, what happens when life does not conform to the shape of the myth that undergirds it? A rift appears in the mythic fabric, and the underlying structure begins to give way, to tear apart. When the lens we look through is shattered, the world loses its shape. Even more profoundly, the myth is also the lens through which we see and define ourselves, and the slightest crack in it is experienced as life-threatening. We resist it fiercely. Always, it is in those areas that have fallen outside the boundaries of the previous mythic world that the new mythic equation emerges. It is the disenfranchised who can most easily see through the myth and create the mythic structure of the new age. And who are we, as people with disabilities, if not a people for whom the myth was never anything but a myth, who always fell outside the boundaries of its reality? We're the ones out of whose experience of life new images will be born. It is ours to do, the gift we have to offer, even to a world that does not want it. Because in deeper terms, the world that does not want it desperately needs it if it is to survive at all. So let me close with some ideas about what we, people with disabilities and others who have survived outside the myth of normalcy, have to offer from our vantage points. From the margins, we bring firsthand knowledge of the suffering that accompanies exclusionary practices. We bear witness against systems, norms, and conduct that deny the physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being of all people. From our struggles, we bring a reservoir of hope, resistance, and perseverance. We bring gifts that have been underutilized. People with disabilities have become skillful in areas we never expected to master. In some cases, we have become the accidental experts with creative alternatives and wisdom to share and guide the church into new and unfamiliar ways of being. From the margin, we bring a different perspective that can stimulate critical thinking and generate new insights. We're in a position to unmask the forces that work against God's will in the world. Those on the margin have the epistemological privilege of knowing what affirms life and what denies it, what helps communities and what hurts them, what helps people to flourish and what threatens it. As we move forward in our understandings of disability, let us remember that a person's gifts and passions are far more important than what the person cannot do. When we can see the many ways that people with disabilities can contribute to our communities of faith, we are freed to see and welcome the vulnerability in our own lives. The community that knows this truth, that the members who seem weak are indispensable, is a community that looks for barriers and takes them down. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing your words and wisdom. And if anyone would like to ask Carolyn a question, I'd be happy to hand you the mic so that you can share your question with the rest of us. Come on, don't be shy.
You can ask anything. Not my work or...
Thank you so much for your wisdom. You were talking about the negative influences, and I was just thinking as you were listing them, how social Darwinism and the survival of the fittest, how that might have also have been a negative influence on how we view the disabled. If that's been part of the conversation, could you share that with us? Or if you've encountered that as part of the conversation of negative image formation with regard to disabled people?
I I think that social Darwinism, and I'm sure people have written papers and presentations on it per se. I don't know that I've read them, but I think that social Darwinism, I think that the eugenics movement, which really started in this country in Canada and then, you know, got exported to Germany, all have contributed to very negative ideas about the worth and value of people with disabilities. There's a recent documentary that was aired on public television, NPR, called Lives Worth Living. That's a documentary, really, of the history of the disability rights movement in this country. And I think that a lot of people with disabilities will run into comments from others like, oh, if I were in your situation, life wouldn't be worth living. And there's a movement, some states, you know, Oregon and Washington have legalized physician-assisted suicide, and there's a bill up, I think, in Vermont, and I know in Massachusetts, that will be voted on this fall to legalize it. And I'm not saying that all people with disabilities are opposed to this, but there's a large contingent that are opposed to it because they see it as... it's a cheaper alternative than providing other medical treatment for people. And one of the cartoons shows someone in a wheelchair and there are steps up to the hospital, you know, where she can get treatment, and there's an easy ramp to the door where she can get a prescription for physician-assisted suicide. So I think that all of those things... Peter Singer is a very renowned bioethicist at Princeton, and an anathema to a lot of the disability community. He's a huge supporter of animal rights. But his idea of disability, in one of the lectures I heard him give, he was saying that really parents ought to be able to decide up until a child is 5 years old whether their life is worth living and then let them be euthanized. He really has a very utilitarian attitude toward life. And it's going to come up more as we look at healthcare costs. And it's true for some people with disabilities to really flourish and to do things and to be about and be a part and participate in the community cost money. But it also costs the state, the country, money to just support them doing nothing.
Does anyone else have a question?
It was exciting to hear you reference the myth of normalcy because Jen actually and Mark Pickens also heard you make that reference before, and they brought it back to our community a few months ago, so that reinforces that idea for us. I want to ask you a question about something that a Methodist bishop in our area has talked about, Bishop Peggy Johnson. She's an advocate for people with disabilities, and she has lifted up the comment that a lot of people make in worship, stand if you are able. And we've got a group of future and current worship leaders in this congregation right now, so this is very relevant to us because we want to show a sensitivity and a genuine inclusiveness of all people. But Bishop Peggy points out that the phrase, stand if you are able, makes the normalcy the ability to stand.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you would comment on that, because people say this around here with all the best intentions. So if you can raise our awareness about that phrase, we'd appreciate it.
I think the bishop has a good point. Why not just say... You know, there's a difference between can and may. Probably learned that as a kid. Even the mother, may I, can I do this, may I do that? You know, you could say you may stand. That gives everyone the option. You know, the mother with the infant, doesn't have to stand, maybe. Somebody might be having back trouble on a certain day and may not want to stand. The other option that I think we're beginning to use in our church is, please rise in spirit or body. You can lift your heart to God. You don't have to raise your body up, you know, to do that. So that's, you know, I was talking to a group the other night at a church in my area, and we were talking about things they could do, moving beyond the ramp. They already have fantastic ramps, and they've got an elevator in their church. How do they move beyond that in really welcoming all people? And we were talking about that, and then someone said, what will it be like if we really accomplish this? And I said, you know, it'll there, maybe there'll be a different demographic makeup of your congregation, and for a while people will be uncomfortable. We're used to doing things certain ways, and if you try to change where everyone can participate, it's going to take some adjustment. And I think we're often loath to give up our habits and our traditions about doing things a certain way, and they need to be examined. I'm not saying throw the whole baby out with the bathwater, but I think, you know, we have an imagination to use it to find ways that we can do something that will make it possible for everyone to participate.
Would anyone else like to share with us?
Just some language on your question. I've always been impressed at the Washington National Cathedral that the rubric is, you may stand or sit as is your custom.
Mm-hmm.
And that means your liturgical custom, and it also means, if you take it that way, your physical custom, whatever it is that makes you comfortable. Because I know in the Episcopal Church, there are many times when some sit and some stand, as is their custom, because some came up in churches where they stand at this point and others prefer to sit or kneel. So we have pop up and pop down at will. So I think that phrasing is very nice.
Mm-hmm. You may sit or stand as is your custom. I like that.
I'm very fascinated by language and how, as you've described on the chart that you gave, which was really helpful, of how what you claim is normal and then what's different than normal. And so I think I'm still really struck by the continued use of the word disabled. And wondered, I've heard differently abled, but wonder if there are there creative strategies to think of whole new categories of language to talk about what we're talking about that doesn't make a normal versus a not normal?
That's a good question, and I think it could be a whole term class to come up with some new words. You know, even within the disability community, there have been disagreements, and then when you get working with people from other countries and other languages, it's even more challenging. At this point in time, in the U.S., when they drafted the Americans with Disabilities Act, and then these international documents like the UN document on the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, for lack of something better, we're using disability, and we're using it more. Even though I was trying to give some ideas that a person in reality doesn't have a quote disability, they have some health condition or impairment, and that in interaction with the environment and attitudes makes it disabling. But we're still used to talking about, you know, a certain attribute as being a disability. And so I think the best we've come up with is people with disabilities. You're not your disability. That's one attribute that you have. This friend who talks about having unique architecture is talking about getting together with someone he knows and really trying to come up with some other terms. there's a problem. I know I worked with the UCC, and when I was on the board, the Human Resources Office was trying to draft new language on non-discrimination. And for people that the governance at that time in the UCC, there are several large boards, and so any decision would go to each board. It would go to one, and then it would go to another. It went to all of them. And if anybody makes a change, it has to keep going around and around, and it was cumbersome. But anyway, they had come up with some euphemism about we do not discriminate. It's basically we do not discriminate against persons with disabilities. And every time I saw it and would comment on it, it would come back with some other euphemism, you know. And we're all differently abled. We all have different abilities. And things that deal just with the body don't include people with psychiatric and intellectual disabilities. So, you know, able-bodied isn't good. Or, you know, it's like some people are afraid to say the word disabled. Oh, that's, you know, I don't want to say the person's disabled. That's a negative thing to say about them. It's like, you know, if you're, I may step on toes. I don't know, if you're trying to describe somebody and say the person's name is Pat or Chris or something, and I have to identify them at the bus station, you know, I can say, is it a man or a woman? That's part of who they are, you know. It would be good to come up with some more words, and I think it would be welcome to have discussions about it. At this point, we haven't come up with a magic word that can describe it without using that. And I think the other thing, when you talked about normal or what's normal or not normal, or normal and abnormal, for someone that's lived most of their life with a disability, that's normal. And the whole division between normal and abnormal I don't think is helpful or useful. It's not easy, and there's room for exploring new possibilities. Does that help some?
Would anyone else like to ask a question? I'll work the way up.
Carolyn, it's been great having you here. I really appreciate your wisdom and your insight and your experience that you bring to the seminary. I did have a question regarding people with disabilities in ministry and service in the church. I think you pointed on that a little bit in your lecture here. I had an opportunity about a year ago with my denomination leading a workshop that was entitled Enabling People with Disabilities for Service. And even though I'm very young and new in this field, still learning in the process and in progress, as a lot of people say, one of the things that in my field study, if you will, that I have run into is a challenge of engaging caregivers of people with disabilities on this topic. I have had an opportunity of interacting with caregivers who are very activist in wanting to enable people with disabilities for service in the wider community. However, I've also had an opportunity to interact with caregivers who I tend to sense a lot of insecurity about enabling people with disabilities, and I'm not quite sure what that insecurity is. I have my own thoughts about that, but I guess what I'm a little more interested to hear from you is how, in your experience, what has worked and what might be some creative ways we could work with caregivers of people with disabilities to help kind of networking and help to give them kind of encouragement that they need to be part of this growing awareness and like I said, network of enabling people with disabilities to serve the wider community.
I think that I graduated from seminary in 97 and as a second or third career, I don't know. But even since that time, I think I am seeing more, not a huge amount, but more and more people with disabilities serving in pastoral roles in congregations and being ordained. There's a man at Harvard Divinity School finishing up, I think, this year. And I remember he came to a panel that I was on 3 years ago when he just started. And his denomination years ago had said there was no way he could be a priest, an Episcopal priest. He's a little person. He uses a scooter. And they said, no way. Well, things have changed, and now he's in seminary. I think that's opening up. I think there needs to be more of that. And just as a sort of an aside, and I'm stretching your question out, more churches are becoming physically accessible in their sanctuary. And I need to quit waving my hands around. And they don't always have restrooms that are accessible, and a lot fewer have a chancel area that's accessible for people with, particularly if they use a walker or a scooter or a wheelchair, or a lectern that's accessible. For caregivers, I think, and a lot of caregivers are in an older generation. I mean, the people we're dealing with now, they're often people in their 40s and 50s and 60s. And I think particularly for parents who have a child, even an adult child with disabilities, a lot of their whole identity is wrapped up in providing care for that person. And to the extent that I think it is sometimes unhealthy, both for the person with the disability and the parents, but they're coming from an earlier age and where they're really seeing the person with a disability as not able, probably as able to do much less than the person possibly could and needing their care. And, I mean, a lot of parents that have children with no disabilities still have a hard time letting go and launching the kids out of the nest and not being so needed, particularly if, you know, gee, I did a really good job of parenting. Why should I give up that role? I know that I have a friend who they had a grant for a while, and they were working with young people who were still living at home with significant disabilities, and they got them out in the community, going places, going shopping. Some of them are beginning to graduate from college now. Their parents were just in awe. They had no idea their children could do the things that they were accomplishing. So I think, you know, as a pastor or working with parents in a congregation, you need to be gentle. But I think, I know from some things I read years ago, and I had a brother who had muscular dystrophy, and he was much younger. He was born when I was a senior in high school. So his sister is closer in age to me, but I didn't grow up with him. I was off in college, then I was married, and he was my brother, but I could look to the side at my parents and watch their parenting of him and you know, started reading up on some things like that. And I think it's hard for a spouse, a parent, a sibling to sometimes really be good in that role when they are also the full-time caregiver. And I think helping people understand that it's okay to bring in, if that's needed, to either help the person with a disability find some other outside activities, if needed, move into some kind of apartment or congregate living situation, to bring in, you know, aides from the outside that can be there. It just seems psychologically healthier both for the person with a disability and for the family to fulfill their role as mother or dad and not all also doing all of the physical, you know, caretaking. Does that help some? It's a hard subject. And parents love their kids and it's hard to let go, and sometimes if that's where the person with a disability has been all their life, they don't have the vision of what they could do without mom and dad right there.
Somebody else. Any other questions? Okay.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
After I ask you this question, I'm going to have to run. I'm interested in your personal story. My question is, at what point in your life were you able to embrace your whole self, identify your voice, and become an advocate for disability concerns? And what was that journey like for you, and what does it continue to be? And if you can answer that in 5 minutes or less, I would really appreciate it. Thank you, Sister Carol.
Are you going to stay for the answer? You know, I was born with a what they call a cavernous hemangioma. It's like a port wine stain. It's a benign tumor of the blood vessels on the side of my face. And you've seen people with just a red mark, maybe often around their eye or on their cheek. This was a lot more involved, and it was a long time ago. And they treated it with radiation when I was just a few days and a few weeks old. And so the tumor subsided, but then that affected the whole, as radiation will often affect the growth of other tissue around it. And in a young child, it affected the growth of that side of my face and the bone structure and the teeth, et cetera, et cetera. And so from the time I was about 9, I think, my parents finally hooked up through some pediatrician with a plastic surgery department in at the University of Texas Medical School in Galveston, and took me every year, every spring, to consult with the doctors in the grand rounds and all these zillions of, you know, people, mostly men, looking at me and poking and discussing what they could do. And I had, over the course of the time from I was 9 to early 20s, about 6 surgeries to cosmetically round out that side of my face. It had nothing to do with the function, which is interesting, thinking about it later. And you know, my mother said, it wasn't good the doctors asked me what I wanted. How did I know? How does even an intelligent, well-educated person really make an informed decision about medical care? You know. Anyway, I think when I was a sophomore in college, they were trying to figure out some dental stuff, and they didn't think that was good. So, well, we could do another operation. And for some reason, I just said, no, I don't think so. I'm going to take a road trip with a friend. And I think I had gotten to the point where, and I never rebelled against this, because I always thought eventually, you know, I was going to have a really kind of symmetrical face that, you know, would work like other people. But I think I had realized that maybe that would never happen, and I had other things to do in life. So we did that, but otherwise, we never talked about it. We never talked about, you know, my family, my sisters. We never talked about what it was like to have people stare at me, to have people make comments, what it was like, the reactions. You know, if people said things, my mother would say, well, just ignore them or tell them you were born that way. Well, that ignoring it doesn't really solve the problem. My brother was born when I was a senior in high school, and it turned out he had muscular dystrophy, and we didn't find that out till he was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old. But that involved the family and a lot of disability advocacy type stuff, and I got involved and got to meet other people. And in the mid-80s, a friend who had gotten to know at church, a woman who had cerebral palsy, And I'd actually contacted her because I was trying to fix something for my brother's wheelchair, and she had the same kind of wheelchair, power chair. And we got talking, and honestly, until then, I had sort of avoided her. People would confuse us with each other. I mean, she used a power wheelchair, and I didn't, but we both had faces that looked a little asymmetrical. But we got to know each other, and she became a wonderful friend and a lot of fun. And then she invited me to serve on the board for an independent living center. Independent living centers got started in the 70s, and they provide services and information for people with disabilities, and at least 50% of the board and a lot of the staff have to be people with disabilities or family members. So I had to, in applying for that, it was a volunteer position, I had to state, was I getting on the board because I had had a brother with a muscular dystrophy, a sibling with a disability, or because I had the experience of growing up as a person with a facial difference. And I decided to come out and, you know, as a person with a facial difference. And I think for me personally, that experience of getting to know and talk in meetings, but then informally with all these other people with all different disabilities, and to share some of the experience of what it was like to go through a lot of medical treatment, how you react to people, was my sort of initiation and a way to talk about things that I never had a chance to talk about, you know, in my family. And that involvement and the people I met and meeting some other people that were obviously disabled and seeing them really just being themselves sort of gave me the permission to be myself. And that and my church work and all involved in sort of came together and other transitions in life, and I ended up at Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. for 2 years and was doing a lot of studying, and I'd always sort of been thinking about seminary and came to seminary, and seminary was a lot of what helped me find a voice. And it was hard because I kind of wrote the course as I went along. There was no course, there was no disability studies program. I just looked at every course I took, whether it was church history or New Testament or spirituality, through the lens of disability. And it was hard because I was somewhere where they talked about race, class, and gender. Those are important. You bring up disability and people are like, well, it's included in those others. It's not really. It's, you know, there's some specific things. It's similar. You know, they're similar. And there are a lot of people, because of race or class or economics or gender issues, have been ostracized or disenfranchised, marginalized. But there's some specifics that are to each one. And it took a lot. And you know, even a good friend back in Texas where I lived when I was talking about seminary and possibly being a minister, and she said, well, wouldn't that be distracting for you to be up there and for people to be looking at you? And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've had some of these attitudes myself, and I see people who are newly disabled later in life, and I think one of the hardest things they have to learn is to really advocate for themselves and be out there. And we're so, I think part of our society is so, put so much emphasis on not inconveniencing people, don't embarrass them, don't do anything, you know, that's going to make a situation awkward. And you have to learn to just let that go. And if people are upset, just deal with it. You know, it's not my whole job to make everybody else comfortable around me all the time and not be myself. And we do that with people of different races, different ethnicities. They're the token person. And no matter, they're taking a course in church history, but then they have to educate everybody about what it's like to be in their position. That happens, but it's not. You know, I'm speaking about it, and it's fine, but it's not the full-time job. And people have to learn get your own information, read up on it, look at, you know, see films, and if you're uncomfortable, figure out a way to deal with it. Does that help? A little?
Are there any other questions that folks would like to ask?
This kind of follows up on what you were touching on. I grew up with two disabled parents.
Uh-huh.
And I spent a lot of time in the communities, and I was what I think I saw was an ongoing tension between not wanting to be defined by a disability, but wanting to be recognized. There was, it seemed like a split or a tension between that. They don't want to be defined necessarily, but they want it to be recognized. Not everyone. And I was wondering, you know, how do you help people navigate through that if I felt like they themselves weren't sure how to handle it, if that makes sense. Does it make sense?
I think no one wants to be seen as more disabled than they are. There are plenty of stories of, you know, I go to the restaurant with a friend in a wheelchair and the wait person asks me what that person wants. And I'm like, ask them. You know, just because a person's using a wheelchair doesn't mean they can't read the menu. That we tend to see if it's obvious one disability and think the person is disabled in all these other ways. And so there's that fear of identity. I think it can be hard because of society's attitudes. Some people make remarks and they get to know someone with a disability and all the things they do and their interest, and they'll say, I don't even see you as disabled. And so maybe that's good. But then the person with a disability might say, but that's part of who I am. You know, you forget some African-American writer, maybe you can help me, I forgot who it was, said, forget that I'm black. But don't ever forget that I'm black. And that tension is there. And I go, you know, blithely through my days, and I go here, and I'm in the stores, and I'm restaurants, and I don't even think about it. And then, you know, something will happen, and it'll throw me back into realizing that somebody I ran into was just really, you know, disturbed. And I say something to them, and it's like they don't hear any of the words. And I'm like, what did they not understand? And then I may realize that they're so distracted trying to figure out why I look different that they're not paying attention. And I don't know where the real truth lies in that, but it's sort of both and. And I think for me, probably getting to know so many other people with disabilities in Texas, then in the Boston area and in the state, and going to things like Society for Disability Studies conferences where nearly everybody there has a disability, and, you know, you're listening to people give their presentations and their scholarly talks with a voice synthesizer, and it's like you get to know people and they're people, and it becomes less of an issue. But a lot of people that aren't so involved in that don't know. You know, if you're a new parent and you have a two-year-old, sometimes it helps to get together with other parents of two-year-olds and share some of your experience and knowledge and frustrations. And I think that different support groups for people with different disabilities can be a real help. My parents got involved in parent group with MDA. I'm not a big fan at all of Jerry Lewis, but the Muscular Dystrophy Association groups and activities where parents could get together and the camps for the kids provided a real connection and a way to talk about this with people who shared a common experience.
Well, I want to be conscious of the time, so thank everyone for coming, and thank you especially, Carolyn, for your presentation.
Thank you for inviting me.
Not a problem. And there are handouts in the back dealing with some of the issues that Carolyn did discuss, such as person-first language and a bibliography of helpful literature about disabilities theology. So I encourage you to grab the handouts on your way out if you haven't already. So thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your day.